You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 25 April, U.S. retail sales data, 2:30 this afternoon. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, we'll chat with Mthethwa Tulari. I want to talk around the rand. Yesterday is 4 weeks until our election. Can we expect more weakness? And then if we have a moment, we'll touch on Zeta results. It really looks like just an unwinding story. Karen McKinnon from Uber Homeland, multi-generational living as it increases in popularity. And then we'll chat with Matthew Basanko from PwC, taxing e-commerce transactions across the continent. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb. What's behind NASPAS and Prosus's recent rally? NASPAS share hit a 52-week high this week, as Tencent has been having a good week. Business Day, Reserve Bank lowers forecasts for damage blackouts will do to GDP. Central Bank expects load shedding to only shave 0.6% from growth this year. U.S. markets, U.S. was green, S&P up 0.02%, NASDAQ up 0.33%. In the East, Sydney is closed for Anzac Day, remembering those who've died in conflict. Tokyo's up 2%, Hong Kong up 0.7%, and Tencent off 0.5%. Commodities, red. Gold, 2,322. Brent, 88.09. Platinum, 910. Palladium, 998. Rand, 1923. Bitcoin, 64,400. And top 40 opening, looking for a red open, 220 points or a third of a percent lower.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Trading now with Mthethwa Tulari. Mthethwa, appreciate the time, of course, from RMB, head of FX and execution. Talking around the rand, the election is sort of looming close. I think my math is wrong. I think yesterday was 5 weeks until we vote, not four. But I mean, can we've seen some rand weakness, some of it in the back of dollar strength. But can we feasibly probably expect the rand to weaken further in the lead up to the election?
Good morning, Simon. And I suppose at this point in time, it's around 34, 35 days left before elections. And I mean, at this point in time, you're seeing the rand trading at around 1922 levels. And I think the move is obviously a global move against the risky assets, which has obviously been weighted down by expectations that interest rates will remain higher for longer, and obviously compounded with the issues out in China and also the uncertainty from a geopolitical perspective in terms of the Middle East and also Eastern Europe. I mean, make no mistake, the Russia-Ukraine situation, that's still also in the background. So I think the market has forgotten about that. But nonetheless, the rand, you know, year to date, that has lost around 3.5%. And also the decline could also be slightly attributed to the weakness that we've seen in metal prices over the past couple of days. But now the big focus after today's US GDP number, you know, today's number, that's going to be the focus this afternoon. And then after that, we now go into sell in May and go away next week from the 1st of May. Now, I think if anything, there's quite a lot of event risk, you know, in the month of May. If you take one step back before you go into the event risk of May, just last year in the month of May 2023, we saw the rand losing 6.7% against the dollar. You know, we started the month of May at 1782. We got up to highs of 1979.
Yeah.
That's just in the month of May of 2023. Now, this year, the event risk is quite high. On the 1st of May, when we go on holiday, on the public holiday, we have the US Fed coming up with their interest rate decision. We're expecting them to keep on hold, but obviously the announcement and the tone from Jerome Powell will be quite, you know, it will be quite interesting to see what he says. It's still data dependent, what's going to be happening. And I think this is where he's really going to allude to the market that don't even price in a September cut. I think if anything, he's going to kick the can down the road. And then on the 3rd of May, which is 2 days later, another big event risk, which is the US jobs numbers, the non-farm payrolls, the first Friday of every month, we're having that. Then, you know, then it starts to lead up to the 29th of May, where we have the elections locally. The uncertainty thereof and how the numbers are going to play themselves out will be obviously playing itself into the rand market. The next day after the elections, I mean, this is quite an interesting one where we have the Reserve Bank locally, Lesetša Kanyako. Obviously, I think we're expecting him to keep rates on hold. But at the same time, whilst he's making his announcement, the market will have to digest the US GDP numbers. So if anything, it's going to be quite a very volatile session come the next day. And obviously, you know, compounded by what the Reserve Bank is saying, the US GDP numbers, and also this is when you're going to start seeing the election numbers trickling in from the IEC. So the market is going to be very volatile. It's going to be very sensitive. It's going to be very skittish. I think we're going to be watching from and moving from one headline to the next. I mean, there's already some market talkers saying the Rand could potentially be at 22, depending on how things play themselves out in terms of, you know, the elections and what happens in the day. But obviously, it's anybody's guess at this point in time.
Yeah, take your point. Lots of event risk ahead in May. Okay, so you lay that out. It's actually quite a spooky looking month. Quick follow-up question around Zeta, the agri company. Results out, looking at it, this really is just a stock that's unwinding and returning value to investors. I mean, there's not actually much to read into the numbers except that they are selling assets.
No, definitely so. I mean, if you think about it, that's an agri-focused business and it's an investment holding company. I mean, if anything, they've obviously sold most of their fruit farm and market, Cape Span, to one of their other investment, you know, neighbors, Agrius. They valued at about 2.6 billion on the JSE, and this is part of the PSG stable. I mean, that's obviously been founded by Yanni Mouton. And I mean, they've been steadily disposing of businesses, and I mean, it's really looking like they really want to try to unlock value for shareholders. And like many investment holding companies, their shares have traded at a discount of about a third to their underlying value, which is quite interesting. They have, you know, from an M&A perspective, quite interesting because they've received several approaches from third parties regarding their remaining portfolio investments, which is the POEM investments and also ZUD. And I think they said that, look, they're going to anticipate that the evaluation of these approaches may take a few months to finalize. So we might see a few disposals still coming to the fore. Nonetheless, I mean, their dividend policy remains to pay dividends conditional on the group having sufficient funds to fund their operations and growth plans if there is any required. So if anything, yesterday, I mean, obviously, it was just a case of them coming to the market and obviously just, you know, giving a bit of certainty with regards to what's going on there.
Yep, and a special dividend of 10 cents, as you say, they return money. We'll leave that there. Mateta Tulari, Head of FX Execution at RMB, appreciate the early morning.
Your money knows that reaching new heights means turbulence. But what if you don't have to feel it? Our partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management gives you access to a broad range of global strategies. So when you invest in StanLib's Global Multi-Strategy Diversified Growth Fund, your money can withstand the ups and downs caused by market fluctuations. Seek more returns at stanlib.com/more. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting now with Corinne McKinnon, Head of Sales at Uber Home Loans. Corinne, appreciate the early morning time. Multi-generational living, which is how we live with our parents, maybe our grandparents or our adult kids are still at home, as the case may be. Data shows that we're actually starting to see an uptick in this happening locally.
100%. Good morning, Simon. So, yes, we are seeing the multi-generational living increase. And we're seeing specifically the trend has been over the last sort of 18 months. This has particularly been driven by the female home buyers, where they're looking to create generational wealth for families down the line. So they're looking long term. So it definitely has seen an uptick in that particular segment of the market.
Okay, that is quite cunning. I mean, one of the pieces of data that came out in the release you sent was that the average home buyer of a new home is 35 for a first-time buyer, which I think is very old. But I like your point there around creating generational wealth, because my question was going to be, is this around the it takes a village to raise a child, or is it around, just simply can't afford, cost-related? But this is, if you're all in one place, it makes a huge amount of sense from a number of aspects.
It does. And what we have seen specifically in the first-time homebuyer market, where we had a huge percentage of our applications from first-time homebuyers coming out of the COVID era, where the rates were so low at 7%, those numbers have dropped off quite significantly as the interest rate cycle has increased. But what that has allowed for that particular segment of the market is to potentially save more for higher deposits, which gets them a better deal and a more attractive home loan when they actually do decide to purchase. So at the moment, we see our applications in the first-time home buyer market tracking at about 46%, and that's off the sort of 56% two and a half years ago.
Do we see this?
But it does allow for the deposit to be saved for. Yeah. And now we're seeing a bigger deposit coming in as opposed to applying for 100% loans.
Gotcha. And then, of course, that just makes easier payment, but also better rates, as you mentioned. Do we see this sort of more prevalent in more expensive parts of the country? I mean, I'm thinking the Atlantic seaboard, although I don't know how you could fit multi-generations in some of those tiny apartments.
So what we are seeing, we are seeing some of it, but the Atlantic seaboard is a specific market, and often that part of the market is not impacted by interest rate cycles. the multi-living is really specifically in the sectional title property market. We're seeing that rise, and that's to help for bigger deposits when there's more than one person purchasing together, living costs, maintenance, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what's driving it because of the price of properties.
Are we seeing developers and municipalities, and maybe it's too early for if the trend's sort of been around for 18 months or 2 years or so, but are the developers and municipalities kind of catering to this? I mean, I'm thinking a traditional three-bedroom house is lacquer, and perhaps you could do multi-generational, but you want probably two lounges in that sort of space. Are they being catered for?
So in the development space, there are pockets, but it's more sectional title. Mm-hmm. And due to the cost of land and the availability of land, you're having smaller units go up as opposed to larger properties. What we're also seeing in that category of sectional title is the younger generation who are looking to purchase have the mindset that maybe they don't want to have this huge big house with all the maintenance. They are able to work all over the world. They don't have to be bound to one particular city. So we are seeing a trend where they are purchasing smaller units, more lock up and go, to be able to work anywhere across the world.
Are we seeing, and then lock up and go, and I'm thinking within an estate perhaps, is that the younger generation are doing a lock and go, but then perhaps they're getting something for their parents in the same estate?
Yes, I don't have specific stats on that, that is certainly a trend. Yeah.
Is this the multi-generational living? I mean, it's certainly happening locally. Is it also a global phenomenon to a degree?
So I think it is due to the economic pressures all over the world. I think this is being forced in other parts of the world, not specific to South Africa.
Yeah, no, I take your point. I look at the housing stats coming out of America and pricing is absolutely head-scratching at points. We leave it there. Queen McKinnon, Head of Sales, Uber Home Loans. Appreciate the early morning.
When you stay invested over time in Stanlib's Global Multi-Strategy Diversified Growth Fund, your money's in for some smooth sailing. With our global partners, JP Morgan Asset Management, at the helm, your money can withstand the pressure and bad weather day-to-day market conditions cause. All aboard? Seek more returns at stanlib.com/more. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Matthew Basenko. He's PwC South Africa Indirect Tax Leader. Matthew, appreciate the time today. E-commerce, the world over, is booming. It's especially booming in Africa. World Bank estimates that digital economy up to, 180 billion of GDP by 2025. I mean, this really is a significant part of economic activity across the continent these days.
Thanks, Simon, for having me on your show. I really appreciate you speaking to me today. And you're certainly right. E-commerce is booming across the continent. And we're seeing increasingly that Africa's entrepreneurial spirit is really coming out in the way that the economy is starting to grow. And of course, of interest to revenue authorities is how they tax these types of transactions, both within Africa and where you've got foreign jurisdictions or foreign suppliers that are supplying electronic services or e-commerce into Africa. And of course, as this becomes a larger part of the economy, the revenue authorities are interested to determine how much they can tax, what the fair tax take is, and of course, collect their component. I think probably the biggest challenge, and you'll see it with the guide that we've published recently, is the complexity across Africa. So Africa is not like the European Union, where you've got a single marketplace, you've got harmonized rules that provide clarity to businesses doing operations in the European Union, or indeed those outside the EU trading with customers in the EU. In Africa, you've got many different jurisdictions with different rules, different approaches, different thresholds to registration. So in some instances, even a single transaction, as small as it may be, may give rise to a requirement to register and to levy VAT. In other places, transactions are only subject to VAT, for example, if it's with a consumer or an end user. But in fact, in distinction to the European Union, most African countries tax business-to-business transactions as well, which creates a lot of complexity for those doing business in the continent.
I take your point. I mean, I remember, and I think it was Pravin Gordhan was finance minister at the time, and he wanted to start taxing sort of the American companies selling digital services into South Africa. And I got to say, I naively thought good luck with that. But truthfully, my software as a service now has a 15% VAT on it. Is there a sort of a move to try and standardize, or is it more a case of the individual countries perhaps needing to get their own legislation and regulations into a place where it's perhaps easier rather than standardized for companies operating?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's very much a matter of each country picking and choosing their own rules and implementing their own rules. But the example you cite on South Africa is an interesting journey, because South Africa was, in fact, very forefront globally, not even in Africa, but globally, in taxing electronic services, and introduced regulations in 2014 that sought to tax transactions between foreign businesses and South African consumers. And at that point in time, there was a very defined list of what was an electronic service and what was not an electronic service. And if you were captured by that list, then the foreign entity would have to register and charge VAT. 5 years later, the five-year itch, as I'll call it, South Africa changed the rules, and in 2019 significantly broadened the scope of the regulation to such that all services supplied electronically, regardless of the nature of the service, regardless of whether it was with a consumer or a business, was required to register. 5 years on, we've seen in the National Treasury, the budget speech from the minister this year, that in fact South Africa is going back again. And in the budget speech, there's a proposal that only business-to-consumer transactions will be taxed, which is much more aligned with what happens in the European Union, but is in fact quite distinct and different from what we see elsewhere on the continent. So our big trading partners, or the big economies in Africa, for the most part, Kenya, Nigeria, Egypt, all tax business-to-business transactions. And in some cases, you find that there's double tax. So, for example, in Kenya, you've got a VAT on electronic services, and you've got a DST, or an electronic digital sales tax, on top as well. That really adds to the consumer cost overall.
Does it, I'm thinking some of the corporates, and they might be in America, or maybe it's a South African corporate into the rest of the continent, or whatever the case is there not a risk that they look at the complexities and think a market is just too small? You know, if you're tapping into a giant market, then the effort is fine and justifiable, but almost a risk where you say that market's just not viable for us because of the extra complexity and burden.
So that is exactly the challenge in terms of doing business across Africa. But because you don't have harmonized rules, because each jurisdiction's got different rules, that cost of compliance, that administrative burden becomes so high. And unlike the African continent, we see the European Union, which has introduced what they call VIDA. Now, that's not a South African coffee shop, but VIDA is what they call VAT in the digital age. And it's around standardizing and harmonizing the rules. So single VAT registration to do business across all the European Union territories, single disclosure, standardized way of operating to make it much easier. That's the direction I think that we should be heading in time.
A last point, the onus on the tax, I'm paying it as the consumer, but the onus on the process is very much on the business. It's not up to me to put my hand up and say to SARS, hey, I owe you some VAT. It needs to be done at the business side, i.e. leaving the consumer paying it, but not having to do the paperwork or the effort.
That's exactly right. So really the burden to administer the tax and collect the tax sits on business. Mm-hmm. The burden to pay the tax, unfortunately, sits on the consumer. But revenue authorities have much more trust in business to collect the tax than they do on the consumer. So that's why the law is structured that way.
We'll leave that there. That's Matthew Basenko. He's PwC's South African Direct Tax Leader. Matthew, appreciate the time today. That's it for today. Breaking news. BHP Group approaches rival miner Anglo-American about takeover. Massive day in the JSE. We were chatting there with Karina McKinnon from Uber Home Loans. Our question today on LinkedIn and Twitter is, are you living in an intergenerational household? And if you are, how's it going? I can see it working great. I can see it working horror as well. Yesterday, we were chatting with Danny Marbus. He's CEO of Finalto South Africa, talking about risks of unregistered derivative providers. We asked you if you were certain your provider is regulated by the FSCA and has an ODP license. Just over half of you said, I'm not trading. Just under half also said, nope, they are quite legit, with the rest saying, not sure. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. The show is brought to you by StanLib. Visit StanLib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobokhle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Michael Jordan on deposit insurance.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.